Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
There's no helicopter rescue, there's no phone signals, we have no sat phone, there's nothing. And it felt so far out there.
Welcome to the Adventure Podcast and episode 48 with Nick Bullock. Nick is a world-class climber, alpinist and mountaineer who in 2017 won the PLA d'Or, which is the Oscars of mountaineering. Nick is also a celebrated author and has had articles, thoughts and stories published in pretty much every climbing and adventure publication worth its salt. I've known Nick for almost 10 years and we've worked together on multiple occasions, often dangling on skinny ropes on the north face of Ben Nevis in the middle of winter. I've always enjoyed chatting with Nick, usually late at night over a glass of red wine in a snow-lined valley somewhere, and Nick and our conversations were one of the original inspirations for starting this podcast. Nick spends most of his time living in his van, but we recorded this conversation in a house he was looking after for a friend in the hills above Llanberis in North Wales. It was a moody, gloomy day, and the rain pattered down on the glass roof above us. A perfect setting for Nick to tell us the tale of his attempted ascent of Mount Gonga in China. So it's a rainy day in North Wales.
Yeah.
Sat with Nick Bullock. We're going to have a talk about... What are we talking about? Mount Gonga.
Are we specifically talking about Mount Gonga?
Well, what do you want to talk about?
Talk about anything. Talk about the world in general if you want. But
I think that's a bad idea.
The world according to Bullock.
Let's talk about Mount Gonga.
I don't think the world according to Bullock would be very good.
So we've done this a few times before, but can you just tell me, for those who don't know, or can you give me a little bit of background info? Who are you? What do you do? I know you hate the question.
Who am I? I've no idea really. Who am I? I've been full-time climbing for last 15 years of my life, and writing since 2000. So I've had two books published, so I suppose you could say I'm an author. And I'm a full-time climber really. But I'm basically just a climbing bum. I would certainly not call myself an athlete, and I wouldn't call myself a professional climber. I'm just somebody who likes to go climbing, and I write.
So, very briefly, how have you ended up living the life you live now? How did you get here?
How did I get here? I left school at 16. I did various jobs. And at 21, I joined the prison service. And at about 20, several years later, I became a PE instructor in the prison service. I found climbing when I did that. I was about 28 years old, and I carried on in the prison service as a PE instructor until I was 37, nearly 38 years old, when I resigned and paid my mortgage off on my house. My house is rented out, and I left the prison service and just went, no fixed abode, full-time climbing, really. Thought it would last for 2 years, and I've now, it was quite a turning point actually on in China, because it was the point where I'd been full-time climbing and writing for as long as I was in the prison service. So just over 15 years now. So yeah.
And can you give me a little bit of expedition history?
Expedition history. 1997 was my first expedition to India and the Meru Shark's Fin. First expedition to Meru Shark's Fin. That's laughable, isn't it? It just shows you kind of, when you first start doing these things, you haven't got a bloody clue. And so that was my first expedition. 10 months later, I went to Pakistan and tried an unclimbed mountain next to K2 called Savoya Kangri, 7,300 metres. Nearly did it. And since then, if you want to, I don't know, is Alaska greater ranges? Would you say Alaska is greater ranges?
It'll do for the, we said expedition history.
Expedition history. Okay, so including those two trips, I've now done 24 expeditions to the greater ranges. First one, like I say, 1997. And they've been to all the main countries you would think of, really, but China, Tibet, Nepal, India, Pakistan, Peru, and Alaska.
And tell me about the latest one.
The latest one, Mount Gonga, or Minyakonka. But Gonga is, I think, what the locals call it. The latest one, the last one, the 24th, the one that I needed to convince me that enough is enough, 7,556 metres, the third highest mountain in the world outside the Himalayas and the Karakoram. Very much off the radar of most climbers. I think it's the farthest eastern, that's the biggest, highest mountain. It's like in the eastern range of the Tibetan plateau. It is actually China. It's in Sichuan region. It's just this massive, massive mountain that just comes from nowhere, really, and just like launches up into the sky from next to nothing. Even though you drive up some pretty hairy roads to a point and then you only walk in for a day, it felt so far removed. It was crazy. No, it's only got one route up it by a very long ridge, I think it's like the northeast ridge. Could be the northwest, but I think it's northeast. Although, no, I think it's while we were there, so a couple of guys did a slightly alternative on the northwest ridge, I think, as well. But it's literally only climbed from one direction, one side. And the side we were going into, of course, had never been. Typical Ramsden sort of outing. Had never been. Nobody had ever. I think Henry Barber tried to get in there years and years ago. But as far as I know, that's the only time anybody's ever gone up this valley and tried to get through this crazy ice fall to get onto the base of the south face, which was pretty massive.
We'll come on to that. Tell me about Ramsden.
Ramsden. Very, very... From Pudsey in Yorkshire, which he's very proud of, I think, even though he escaped it because it's meant to be very rough. I was reading a load of books. Have you heard of a guy called David Peace, writer? He wrote... So there was a trilogy of films on Channel 4 called The Red Riding... trilogy of films that were brilliant films, but they come from a quartet of books from a writer called David Peace, and I took all four of them out with me. Not easy reading about loads of death and paedophiles and things. Crazy, but it's all about Pudsey. It's all got Pudsey and where Paul's from, and so it's pretty rough, I think, Pudsey, but I might be speaking unfairly, as I've never been there before, but Paul's from Yorkshire, very, I think, very proud of being Yorkshire, very working class upbringing. You know, it's like four BL doors he's been awarded. For three of them were things with Mick Fowler. One of them was with me in Tibet a couple of years ago. Very strong and driven. One of the most, I think he's, you know, people in the know who Paul is, but very underrated, under the radar, world-class mountaineer that is British and nobody really knows about him.
So how did the two of you end up on a plane to China together?
Well, like I said, Paul and myself, we'd met each other once before a long time ago, but Paul contacted me in 2016 and wanted to go somewhere, and eventually I agreed and we went, and we had a really, I was going to say a really good time, but we had a successful time, if you class success as summiting a very rarely climbed mountain by a new route. But just going to Tibet alone, by all accounts, was a pretty special thing, because not many people get granted permits to go to Tibet and climb. So that was how, and we spent, I don't know, what did we spend, 4 or 5 weeks together on that trip, and had a good time sort of thing. And so I agreed to do another trip, because it's just getting to the point where I just really, really have done enough. I'm 52, 53 in a month's time, and I'm getting quite superstitious. Not want to get too deep and dark straight away, but about how much time I've spent in the mountains and how many things I've tried. And I know so many people that have died now, especially in the last several years. And you just, I don't know, I think you get to a point in life, or I've got to a point in my life, where I'm starting to think, well, when is it going to happen to me? And so I'm trying my best to get out of it. And I don't think the Tibet trip was the best to get out of it, because it was too successful, too much good fun, too big a high at the end of it. Too many people contacting me and wanting me to do stuff, which is very good for your ego. And so I needed a big fail.
But there's footage of you at the end of the Tibet trip saying, I'm never, ever, ever doing this again.
Yeah.
Self-shot footage.
Yeah.
So why did you change your mind?
Why did I change it? It does, you know, you can't get over the fact that if you're into doing that sort of thing, it happens so... It's for me anyway. For me, not for Paul. Paul's pretty successful, but for me, it happens so little, that success of a thing like that, and it does give me such a great like feeling. And I could just finish it at that, but I could just say that's it and that's enough. But it isn't, because it also gives you credibility. It gives you a big high when you get all these emails from people praising you and saying, well done, and can you write us this, and can you write us that, and can you do me this film, and can you do me that film, and it makes you feel pretty good about yourself. And totally the wrong reason to want to do it again, but as somebody who's dedicated his life now to climbing and writing, it's a great opportunity as well. And so there's loads of different reasons to want to do it or want to feel that again.
To what extent do you think there's an expectation for you to go on a big expedition and get another Pilé d'Or? Is that a motive?
I don't know whether it's my own expectation. It's certainly a motive.
It's part of what elite mountaineers do.
Yeah, although I don't consider myself as an elite mountaineer. I'm a climbing bum who writes. As a sponsored climber, it's what I'm sponsored. I get money, not loads, but I don't live on a lot, but what I get makes a big difference in my life, and it certainly plays on my mind to kind of go, well, I'm not doing any more of that, because then I think, well, I'm gonna get dropped. And so definitely plays a big part. It plays a part for sure.
So where did it start with Gonga when you got them? You know, how did Paul get in touch?
And how he actually didn't. It started with me contacting him and saying, okay, I'll do another. What a knob. What a knob. I just thought it was, I really enjoyed the whole trip. Actually, I really enjoy, you know, if we, not to go away from the dark side of things for a minute, I really enjoy being absolutely knackered, wasted, but having done something like that. It's been a big part of my life for 97? So how many years is that?
It's a lot of years.
Yeah, and I was climbing before that, you know, so I started climbing a few years before that. So it's been a big part of my life and a big driving thing in my life. And so it's very difficult to kind of go, you know, I'm not going to go back. And especially after such as, like, it was, you know, it's great. I love lying there, being absolutely knackered and lying there. But I like lying there. I also like, it's such a crazy feeling, because I like lying there knowing I'm safe after. I like lying there knowing I'm going to eat some nice food. I like lying there being warm. I like lying there being safe and having these things around me. Now, in some respects, that's a terrible reason to go and do something.
Why
like
is that a terrible reason? What's wrong with that as a reason?
Because you should be able to. I was going to say if you were a normal person, but that's, I don't like that word. If you were, I don't know, I can only speak for myself. If I was a well-balanced person, I could probably enjoy life and then things without having to do that. And I think now I'm older and I think I've lived through this and got to this point, I think I do really enjoy, and I can appreciate this life. But then something comes along like the Tibet thing, and it kind of goes, whoa, this is amazing. But then these things suddenly become brighter and become more in focus. And you appreciate them even more for that short period. And it's a good, for me, I find that a good feeling. I don't know if it's the right reason to go and risk your life anymore.
So before we talk about whether or not you really are stopping or going again, etc., tell me about Mount Gonga and the trip. Where did it start? What did you do? What was the point that you thought you were going to turn around? You know, tell me about the trip.
Okay, so we went, we got there immediately. We couldn't go in, we couldn't walk in the way everybody, because it's like, what we didn't know was, is there's quite a lot of the Chinese people go there and they trek right through where we had our base camp and go up to like Gonga base camp, and then they try this 5,900 meters. Some people do, some people just go to the, and they kind of trek up there. Well, we couldn't do that because the bridges had all washed away. And they were rebuilding them, but they still couldn't do it. So we couldn't take the horses. So we went in to this little village, landed in a car, this little village, and the next morning we had to walk up to the monastery, which is normal walking. And then when you drop down from the monastery, we then had to go over the top of these 5,000 meter hills, like from 2,000 meters. So we went from 2,000 meters in a day over these 5,000 meter hills to drop down to come back into the valley in this other way. This was day one. And we got there, it was going dark. We lost the liaison officer and the cook because they decided to go down this hill in the mist the wrong way. We followed the horsemen, we were shouting them, they carried on. And We thought we'd lost them. We thought they'd got fallen into the river and been washed up. This is like day one. But we eventually got to base camp, and what we were intending to do was, so then the base camp's here, 4,100 metres, and we were going to go up this valley that very few people have been up and try and get onto the south face, which starts at 5,700 metres, which we didn't know at the time because nobody had been up there. There's no, it wasn't even any full pictures of the face. We didn't know at all what we were going into. And we were hoping to like do a route up the south face, a new route, summit, and then either come down the same way or do the standard route down, which is a 2-day ridge. And so that's what we were hoping to do. It snowed every day for the first three weeks. Every day it snowed.
And when you say snowed, I assume you mean
some of it. It wasn't like total expedition stopping snow, but it was for several hours of every day or through the night. There was snow. Not like mega dumping, but there was snow. And when it snows like that in the valley at 4,000 metres, it snows generally a lot more higher up. And so that played a significant part on what happened. We carried on through all the snow and we acclimatised up to 5,700 metres by going through. It took us 3 days to get to the base of the face and two acclimatization trips. The walk up the valley was just, it was a big approach, mass. We should have gone and put an ABC in. We needed a bigger team really, and we needed like a bigger team. People probably trying different things to establish an ABC because it was such a long way in a. Like 1600 meters of ascent just from base camp to the base of the route. And there was just me and Paul. And once we kind of started walking out there, we were, you know, there's no helicopter rescue, there's no phone signals, we have no sat phone, there's nothing. And it felt so far out there. And you had to go through this ice fall that was kind of like, I christened a death ice fall because it changed all the time and covered our tracks with ice avalanches. And to get to the base of the face, and on a few occasions we were up there and then it dumped loads of snow. And you just think, all I was thinking was, is God, we're going to get trapped up here. Paul didn't seem to bother much too much about it because he's like, we'll be fine. And he fell down loads of holes coming as we're coming back through on the second time, just all over. And it was knackering. It was so knackering and it was so far to get back to base camp.
For those that don't know, what do you mean fell down loads of hops? Like what's involved?
Like, so you joined together on a rope going through this crazy ice fall that nobody had ever, we were the first people ever, let's establish that, to get to the base of this face and to even like take a picture of it. The whole face. Bruce Norman has taken, I think, a long distance one, and Tom, I can't say Tom's surname, the Japanese guy who takes all really brilliant pictures, has taken a long distance one from way, way, way back from a col. But we're the only people to see this whole face and get through this ice fall. So that's kind of like the level this was at straight away, before you're even getting on the climb. And this ice fall was dangerous. So the holes, it was full of seracs, like big like fall down kind of hanging in space sort of holes. And because it had snowed so much the second time we were up, well, in the first time it snowed so much actually, but we didn't get quite high enough, right on the level beneath the face. So that snowed loads and we bailed a day early because there was so much snow. Paul's out front because Paul's like a homing pigeon and he's very good at that sort of thing and he's stronger than me. So I'm just like pushing out front and he's just like, so all the holes, all the slots are covered and he's just going down them all. But because I've got him on quite a tight rope, I'm being able to hold him and he's just like going into like up to his waist or something and jumping out of them. And the second time there was even more snow and it's just crazy. He was just like poof, down them. And this ice, you know, this ice fall was so serious. And I was like, you know, I was actually, because I can't remember how to do like these crevasse rescues, and it's like, what were you, two of us, middle of there, nobody's coming for us, and like, I'm thinking, well, brilliant, Paul's gonna like be hanging there, I'm gonna not be able to do anything, and we're just gonna sit there for days.
He's not little, is he?
And he's not little, no. He's bigger than me. That's just around his belly. But it's all very stressful. Just, and this isn't even getting on the climb. It's all very stressful. Just what, being up
what,
there.
What are we talking time wise on this death?
So a day. A day. So we spent over a, both times we spent about a day getting through it, going up. And then, but coming back down, we could get all the way back down from underneath the face, we could get all the way back down to our base camp. And that took from about 8 in the morning till 5 in the afternoon. But getting back absolutely knackered.
And these are just recces.
These are recces. Yeah, this is a recce. This is just acclimatisation.
And so how are you feeling as you're walking up this thing? What's going through your head?
Actually, going through my head a lot was Paul Nunn was 52 years old when he died of a Serac fall. And that was going through my head a lot. I'm 52. And Paul Nunn is one of these quite inspirational characters from when I was getting into all this and what have you, and you know, and Paul Nunn, basically it was a total surprise. He was coming back down, I think, from making a successful ascent of a mountain in Pakistan, can't remember the name, and literally you had to cross underneath a Serac for like 10 or 15 minutes and it went and it killed him. And I think Paul Nunn was, for me personally, he was one of these, had been doing so much all his life, he was indestructible, and all of a sudden he's dead. And I was thinking a lot of Paul Nunn. And I've become very superstitious over the last few years. And it played on my mind a lot, played on my mind being stuck up there, played on my mind Paul falling down a crevasse and not being able to do anything about it. Played on my mind having been killed by Serac fall. This is before you're getting on this route, yeah, that's 1,800 metres. So you have to do 2 days. We got it down to 2 days, but 1,600 metres of ascent from base camp, 2 days go through this death ice fall to get to the base of the face, to then strap it onto this 1,800 metre face that goes up to 7,500 metres, that then you have to get 2 days off coming down a ridge. And
so as you're walking up, thinking about the possibilities, what's this doing to your motivation?
It doesn't do a lot for my motivation, if I'm honest, because I'm not a psychopath.
But does it always feel like that?
No. Whatever possessed me to go on this trip, in a way, with Paul, where it's the hardest thing I've ever tried in my life, and I'm now at the point where I'm less fit than I've ever been for years, and I'm old, I'm 52, so I'm old, and all of a sudden I'm strapping it onto this world-class objective, the hardest thing I've ever tried in my life. What was that all about? And the thing that it's all about is one is ego, two is it does give you this amazing experience that if you live through, you can lie down and go, wow, for a while until that wears off. Three, it adds to my ability to make money and survive, which is bollocks, totally the wrong thing.
There's an irony in that. Putting yourself in that situation so that you can make money and survive.
Yeah, that is, yeah. It's a collection of things. It's a collection of things. Some are good, some are not so good. And I it'd be very easy for me to say, anybody who goes to the mountain feels that way, but I don't think they do. But I think there's more of it that goes on than people will admit to, or they even believe themselves, because they're lying to themselves a lot of the time.
Why?
Why are they lying?
What are they saying to themselves, and why are they lying to themselves? Why are they in denial, or what are they?
Why? Well, why are they in denial? I don't know. It's a good question. Why are people like that? Why mountaineers? What is it? I don't know. Why do people take crack cocaine?
Well, because they're addicted to it, and because their mates said it was a good idea at the start.
And then throw in, actually, it can be life enhancing. It can give you this amazing life, or it can give you the euphoria for a very short period in your life. It can totally play on your ego and like give you this, you know, it can give you all of these things as well. It's not illegal.
Could you not get the same kick from doing a big bike ride?
I do get a kick from bike ride, actually. I get quite a buzz from bike rides, but it certainly doesn't give you that kind of kick. I'm sure, you know, if I was good enough to go and do the Tour de France and you could win that, well, maybe that's different again, but we're not talking about that, are we? We're talking about me cycling around to Beth Gellert on the hippie's bike. Which does give me quite a buzz. I push pretty hard, but it doesn't give you that much of a buzz. It also doesn't give you the ego thing where people are contacting you and you're not being asked to do talks and
all that sort of thing. Unless you win the Tour de France.
Unless you win the Tour de France. Although I was just reading recently, I read something yesterday about Bradley Wiggins, and he reckoned it kind of, in some respects, has ruined his life.
Right. Well, I have to go and interview him.
Yeah.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So let's get back to Gonga. So you did two recces. They didn't necessarily go well.
No, we did them okay. They went all right. We only got up to 5,700 metres and we spent 2 days up at 5,700 metres. Under the face, had a look at it, but it's not the sort of thing that you want to look at. Like even Paul said, normally it would be like you go and do a recce on an opposite somewhere, you get higher, and he would be able to like watch the face, even draw a topo, really give it some like time. We didn't have that opportunity.
Why not?
Because of the difficulty in getting to it. And the fact that we didn't know anything about it, nobody knew anything about it beforehand. And it's such a big effort just getting up there and getting through the icefall, and dangerous, that you didn't want to kind of... And there was just nothing else really around that you could... We could have gone and probably got on the standard route, which would have got us up to about 5.8 on the ridge and then pushed it out. But we needed to put the time in going up this valley.
Is there an ethical issue with that or not? Does it feel a bit like abseiling in and then on-sighting something? Or
no, would not you, at all.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have had any problem at all if it had been perfect weather and we knew we could get through here. If we could have got through there, got to the base of the face in a single push without the snow, without the big effort, and then come back down without like properly knackering ourselves, and then... We could have said, right, well, we're up to five. Let's go up on the standard route and go and climb up that as far as we can and then come back down which will give us knowledge of that as well. That would have been, you know, that would have been in a way a perfect scenario, but it just, everything was just, it's just such a big effort. And it was snowing loads in the first 3 weeks while we were trying to get acclimatised. And the effort to just go and do that would have been pretty big. And we needed to kind of get through to see the face. On that first acclimatisation, we didn't see the face at all. It was just clouded in all the time.
That must have been ominous in itself.
So we didn't even know there was a line. We didn't know what, so we had to go in that second. And by the time we'd gone in the second time, you kind of committed so much to going in and finding a way and getting through and getting to see the face and having a look at it. And desensitising in a way. You need to desensitise to kind of get used to your surroundings before you go, right, well, we're going to commit it onto a 7,500-metre mountain now up this face, this 1,800-metre face. And so we had to kind of commit to that way, not doing that. Too easy in a way to say, people say it all the time, oh, you know, conditions. People have been saying it to me, oh, well, you know, the weather was a bit, I hear the weather was shit, or, and it'd be very easy for me to just turn around and say, yeah, the weather was crap, conditions weren't good, we didn't do it. But actually, I'm 90% convinced that everything could have been perfect. We'd have got on the face, we wouldn't have done it. I'm too old, not good enough. Too committed.
So before we come on to the face itself, if I understand right, you did the second recce and came back down to base camp.
Yeah.
What's that like? What did you do in base camp? How long were you there?
Base camp was great. We had Mr. Pan, the liaison officer, who was a real character, and he was just great. He was a great person, actually. And in all the trips I've done, when it comes down to having a liaison officer, he was brilliant. It was really good fun.
How so? What was good about him?
He was just a cool guy, you know. He was cool. He was just a laugh. He listened to it like he's older than, he's 57, and he looked like younger than, he looked really quite young, but he was cool. He listened to like all like Western music, which kind of surprised you a bit, but it was all like, it was really like, he listened to loads of like Motown and stuff, and it was so cool. So funny, and he was like, smoked loads, and then they would like, he was now an alcoholic. They used to drink this like 52% rice wine every dinner and every evening, and I started calling it, what was it, medicine or something, and he was like, yeah, I'm gonna have my medicine. And it was, yeah, so, and then Mr. Chong the cook was ex-forces, he was a bit serious actually with his chopper. Not his chopper, his chopper. It could have been scary with his chopper as well, I don't know.
Luckily he wasn't.
But yeah, he was, so it was quite cool being there and hanging out with them, and pretty comfortable.
But do you manage to put it out of your mind, you know, you've just done two recces, you're back in base camp with those guys?
It doesn't last for long, not for me anyway. Paul seems to cope all pretty well with it, and he seems to be pretty level-headed with it all. And I think there was more going on this time than the previous time. And I think maybe it was just all my talk of people dying in superstition that infected Paul as well. But so when we were going back down, I was basically saying to Paul, right, I need a minimum of 3 to 4 days because I was knackered. And so for the first couple of days it's fine and I can relax and whatever, but then it starts like this like insipid dread that we were going back up there was definitely, something I've got better at over the years is like breaking it down, saying, okay, well, the first day we're just going to go to there and that's fine. But then you have to go through this fucking icefall. And this icefall was just death on a stick. And Paul was like going, oh, well, you've been through things like this before. And I was like, yeah, I have, Paul. And probably didn't enjoy it then, but I was a lot younger and I was more stupid.
But to what extent is it skill? I mean, the face is a different beast. But to what extent is the ice fall skill or luck?
Luck.
100%?
Yeah, near enough. When you're going through things like that, it's it's like a flip of a coin.
Yeah, so the more you go, the more you...
You know, you could be going through a lot worse. Let's not overplay it. The first time I went through it, I thought, okay, it's not too bad. But then when we came back down, under all the snow, it was like, ooh, and like dropping down holes and things. But then the second time we went up, and all our tracks had been covered by ice avalanches from collapsing seracs, suddenly then I was like, holy shit, this ice fall is moving a lot. And then it's changed again when you come back down. Then you go back up and even more tracks have been obliterated. And you kind of go, actually, this is really, really dangerous. And so there's not a lot of skill involved in staying alive going through them things.
If you're operating at a level where you're going on an expedition to that part of the world, you know, I guess it's luck when you're actually walking through the icefall itself.
Hmm.
So what about the attempt then?
Well, there wasn't one.
Did you not even try? I didn't realise that.
No. We woke up. So it was a 2 days approach. We took 8 days food with us. We had 2 days of 2 days approached, so we had 6 days food left. We had about 9 days overall before we had to walk out and drive out, get to Chengdu and catch the plane. Well, that was probably like 12 days. So we had like 10 days left. And we went in, we went in for 2 days, we walked in, we had 6 days food in our bags. We got them all ready under the face. We went to bed and we woke up to complete whiteout and snowing. And we didn't have the food in our bags to kind of hang out for a day or so up there and wait it out to see what happened. We had to get on the face because it was going to take a minimum of 6 days to climb, at least maybe seven to the summit. We had 6 days food and then it was going to take 2 days to get off it.
And you only realise this once you get to the bottom on your second recce.
And... well, we knew it was probably going to be an overall 10-day outing from base camp to base camp, minimum. We knew that, after the second recce. But, yeah, we weren't going, we didn't, we knew, even before we got there, we both experienced enough to know that this was going to be massive.
So what's the, because I've obviously never done anything like that, what's the logic behind only taking 6 days food?
You can't carry anymore. Wait, we took eight.
Sorry, yeah. And obviously you've got the gas as well.
So. And we had five cylinders of gas between the two of us. Five cylinders of gas, 8 days food. And even then the food was down to like 400, like a meal was going to be 400 calories.
Yeah. So it's nowhere near. I mean, you're...
So, you know, you...
You're operating at a deficit from day one.
We're operating at a deficit on the bloody...
walking
on the approach,
yeah,
and then you're going to strap it on an 1800 meter route that tops out at 7500 meters that has another 2 days to come off it.
So you woke up in the morning,
white out, snow. Paul turned to me and goes, oh, it's snowing, it's white out, how psyched are you? And I went, not very. And he went, no, I don't think I am either. I said, good, let's get down.
Was it that simple?
Yeah,
no fighting, no argument,
no messing. Paul beat himself up a bit, but on the way down, and you could see he was a little bit, but I don't think, I'm pretty sure, if you speak to Paul now or you ask him, I'm pretty sure he would be saying it was the right decision.
It sounds like the right decision.
It was the right
decision. So what goes through your head in that moment? Is it just, get me out of here?
Me, I was kind of, like I say, I'm pretty sure I've reached the point where I was kind of going, I'm glad to be. Well, even then, I couldn't go. I'm glad to get out alive because we had to go through the ice fall.
As you say.
So even then I wasn't like, because we kind of went, okay, enough's enough. And we shook hands and we said, let's get out of here. But then even then it took us, we were through the ice fall and back below. And I said, we did that a bit prematurely, didn't we? And Paul was like, yeah. And we shook hands again then and we said, right, I think we're going to live now.
Yeah. So how do the, you know, when we've talked before, we always end up talking about this, but what's the emotional journey? What changes in your head? You know, when do you start thinking, oh, maybe we should have, or does that not happen?
Maybe you should have what? Pushed harder or had a go? I think in previous trips in my life, I've definitely had that. I have had that, for sure. And I know for a fact in previous trips, we could have, and there could have been, I can think of one straight away. I'm not going to probably name it because it wasn't anything really my decision that we came off. It was somebody else's decision. And I personally think we could have had a right good go and we should have a bit more, tried a bit harder. But, you know, if one of you isn't into it, there's nothing you can do. And you should respect the other person who you're tied on with and you should come down. That's all there is to it. But there are a couple of things probably that I've tried that, but most of the things I've tried, I think I've tried pretty bloody hard and I've had several attempts at things and, you know, really given it a big effort. Even on that one thing that I've talked about then, I gave it quite an effort. But I think, you know, so it does. But on this occasion, I had absolutely no problem at all coming down.
How did you feel walking out?
I felt euphorious. It was great. There were birds tweeting, and the trees were green, and there was like this like amazing moss hanging from the trees, and the sun was shining, and it was lovely. It was a lovely day. It was great to walk out. Because I certainly thought there might be opportunity, might be a time when I wouldn't. And a lot of that also, that's that kind of stress. It wasn't just because I'm at this point in my life and I'm at this certain age and I don't feel fit enough to try that. Like, don't get me wrong, I don't think there'd have been a problem if Paul had found us a 6,500 metre mountain to go and try a technical route up. As long as the weather had been fine, we'd have given it a good go and we'd have probably done it. I have no problem about that. This, you've got to get it in your mind that this was a very seldom climbed 7,500 metre mountain in the middle of nowhere with just two of us getting on it, going up a valley where nobody had ever been before through a death icefall, miles away from base camp. And it was the kind of the wrong approach for really for what we were trying, but nobody knew about it. So in some respects, if Paul had got us a 6,500 metre technical mountain like some of the things he'd done in the past with Mick, we'd have probably done it and it'd be great. But in some respects, that wouldn't have done the job, because the job was, as I want to finish doing this while I'm still alive. I want to enjoy my life.
Yeah.
and finishing on a bad one is quite easy to go, okay, I've probably done enough of this. I think I've done enough of this now. Whereas finishing on a really good one like Nangan Tagla that 2 years before wasn't good, because then it feeds all this stuff that keeps you going.
Yeah. So when, I can't remember exactly what you said, but when you emailed me when you got back, you said that you were looking forward to chatting because lots had changed.
Yeah, I think I'm looking more and more. I'm 52, nearly 53, and so many people that I know have died. And it just starts, you know, as you get older, and I know statistics don't, I'm told by people who know about statistics, it doesn't work like this, but I can tell them that the more you put yourself in a dangerous situation, the more chance you have of dying. And I don't give a shit about their statistics. That's true. It can't be anything other than if you keep going and going, putting yourself in this situation, at some point, something is possibly going to happen. And it has happened to so many people I would call friends. And it just starts to play on your mind more and more as you get older and you put yourself in this position. And I'm at the point now. I think I was talking to somebody at the climbing wall last night and he was saying, yeah, it's like weird that he understood, because I said, pretty sure I've done 24 of these bloody things. And some are, most of them I've tried really hard on, and a lot of them have been pretty dangerous and pretty out there and very, very, like, close to being world-class objectives. That's why I failed, I think, on nearly all of them. But it doesn't stop the danger, and it doesn't stop you trying really hard and pushing to the limit. And I'm just at the point where I feel pretty happy with what I've done, how I am, who I am, where I am. And I think it just comes to a point where I don't need to, I'm happy. I think it's also probably something to do with like being happy in your life anyway, around, you know, as well. You know, that helps a lot.
To what extent, this might sound really over the top and you can laugh at me, to what extent do you think you've maybe got survivor guilt?
I think probably one point in my life I might have had a little bit of that. I don't think I've got survivor guilt at all. I don't even know what... Can you give me the definition of survivor guilt?
No, I can't. It just makes me think... I shouldn't use this analogy, but it makes me think of soldiers. It makes me think of people that come home after a long, hard tour whose friends have died. They've done the same thing as them. They come home and they just think, why was it him and not me? You know, his family have had to go through that. I'm left here. Do you experience the same thing as a mountaineer?
I think it's quite a different thing, using one as a metaphor for the other, for the like the army soldier thing, because I don't know enough about that, but they're doing that for a very different reason than a privileged person's going to the mountains.
Yeah. It makes me think of the Comrade Anchor Alex Lowe thing. Of, you know, Comrade Anchor talks about how he doesn't understand why it was Alex and not him. And I wonder if there's the same thing with you, with Jules maybe, or... Because to get a little bit deep, have you been in situations where people have died on the expedition that you've been on?
I've actually been very, very fortunate. And I have never experienced death in the mountains firsthand. And I never want to. and I'm very fortunate for that.
It's just suddenly people disappear.
Yeah, you know, people who I know, you know.
So how are you looking at things now? Life-wise, climbing-wise?
Climbing-wise, I could easily talk about the big mountains and mountaineering, because people rave about it. And I could easily go, I could be quite cynical about it now. But it's very easy to be cynical about something when you've experienced it for 25 years of your life and you've gone through those highs. So it would probably be unfair for me to say to people, you shouldn't do that. But I would say what I would say now that I probably wouldn't have at one point in my life, is I would say you should go into it with your eyes very, very open, and you should, and you should take heed that you might not come back. And I would also say you're not going to come back a hero, even if you succeed and you do a brilliant new route on the map. You're not a fucking hero.
Do you not think Alex Honnold has come back a hero?
Alex isn't a hero. Alex, I've met him and I found him quite an interesting person. Alex has mental health issues. And in some ways, we're all supporting that, and
it's like the article, isn't it?
Well, it is, and we're all like supporting his mental health issues. We're not treating him, we're encouraging him.
So when somebody sends you an email or comments on your blog saying you know, a credible mountaineer, someone you respect, who you know is a bit of a, I won't say a hero, a talented alpinist, says, Nick, please can I have all the photos from Gonga and any advice on going? Are you going to turn around and say, please don't go, it's a...
No, I would be completely... Because I've actually, a friend of mine who I spoke to a few days ago even, I said to him, I can give you... He didn't ask me about it. I just said, if you want a world-class objective that I think you possibly will be good enough to go and try, I can tell you, I can give you the whole facts about this. But I wouldn't sort of fluff it up at all. I would say, you're going to risk your life going through that icefall. You have to decide whether you want to do that.
And I know, obviously, you know, you don't have any part to play in whether or not he does go and whether or not he does get hurt or come back successfully. But when that person says, I am going to go and do it, and they get on a plane, are you going to be affected by that in any way?
Well, I would be. I'd be concerned if that one person, because I'm friends with him and I like, if he then went and tried this thing, I probably would feel in some ways responsible, yeah. But there will be people, you know, I'm hoping to write something now about this trip and about my feelings and about the way I feel about, like, my life has changed. Raining quite well, isn't it?
It's hammering it down.
How's that going to affect your recording?
That's all right, don't worry. We're ready.
Yeah. Well, we're in North Wales, aren't we? What can you expect? So the way... kind of lost my thread a bit with the rain. But so people will, when I write about this and put pictures out there, without a doubt, because people will go and try this mountain and this face. They will, because it's world class and in some way. But there's no doubt about it. It's what we live with nowadays, because people follow. They kind of see pictures and rightly or wrongly, they don't go and try things that they don't know about or people can't give them a load of information on.
Why is that? I'm really interested in that.
I think it's the sign of the times, isn't it? I think a lot of imagination has gone out of people. How about that? There's something that will wind people up. But I think a lot of people lack imagination nowadays, because if they don't get... They don't want to go to Scotland unless they know a route's totally in condition has been done a lot of the time. They don't want to go to the Alps unless it's got a trail broken into the base of a north face and it's been done several times and it's in squeaky, squeaky, amazing condition. They don't go to the greater ranges unless something's been tried, shall I say, 30 times?
It's not contentious at all.
and it's got a massive, massive reputation that's going to enhance their personal reputation and fluff their ego up even more. There are people out there, of course, who still do go and try things that not a lot is known about. But after Nangan Tagler, it's amazing the amount. I'm sure Paul had a lot more. The people emailing me basically wanting me to, like, serve them the range on a dish and give them so much, loads of information about how to do things and how to get in there and what else there is there and show them pictures and show them what, you know, it's like, for fuck's sake, people, just go and try, just go and have a bit of a poke at something. And
is it generational, or are there young people who are still doing what?
There will be young people still, obviously, of course. It's going to be all over. It's going to be all ages. And there'll be people who are still trying. In fact, I know there are people, still young people, trying to do things that people don't really know about and very little is known about. And they probably know that they're going to go and fail, but they'll have a poke anyway. And then there are older people who want it all serving on the plate. But there are... I think it is an internet thing that there is so much information out there now. People have become accustomed to having information and wanting information and don't feel things are either worth it or safe enough or credible enough unless they have all this information.
So to be mean to you,
yeah,
how do you justify the fact that you're contributing to that?
I can't. I'm totally contributing to it. I live with confliction. What was the thing that we were talking about earlier on?
The dissonance.
The dissonance.
Was it?
Yeah, it was. I wish I had it still.
Cognitive dissonance.
Cognitive dissonance. It is that. It's more than that, actually. So I do have cognitive dissonance as well, which, for those of you that don't know what it is, because I didn't until about 2 hours ago, until I looked it up on Wikipedia. It's kind of when you live with, in some ways, with a very strong belief, but something comes along and questions that belief and makes you kind of a bit stressed or stirred up inside. That's in very simplified. And I think I cope pretty well with that because I am more open, but I think that's a getting older thing or a thing. I look at myself a lot and question a lot of what I do. So, but I do also live with quite a lot of confliction and yeah, I am part of that. And I would love in some respects now in my life not to be part of it in a way.
It's not that simple though, is it?
But it isn't that simple because it's the life I've kind of still I've set out for myself now. And the only way I would say I cope with it is by trying to keep it under control to a level where I'm happy.
Your benchmark.
My benchmark, which means jack shit.
Well, it's set by you, isn't it?
Set by me, yeah. Which people will call me a hypocrite and people will also go, he's not doing enough.
Sure.
And as long as I can wake up in the morning and I feel reasonably happy with my decisions and choices, I think that's my answer to your question.
And my final question, because we can read about, you know, you are going to write the blog by the time this goes online.
I don't know if I'll write a blog. I'm trying to, well, no, because I'm trying to write a piece for a magazine so I get paid.
Ah, right, well.
But I'll definitely put something on my blog, but it won't be anything like this. It'll probably be, we went, we saw, we failed, we came back.
Well, there's the magazine piece.
Here's a couple of pictures.
I'll link the magazine piece to this so that people can read the conclusion when you finally worked on it.
If I can get it published. Because it'd be dark.
Yeah, some people like that. Yeah. Some of us. Yeah. Final question. I've asked you this every time I've interviewed you for the past 5 years, maybe. Are you going to go again?
I'm pretty sure. You know, what you've got to look at is you've got to look at go again. What do you mean by go again? Go where again?
On expedition.
So, I love doing massive, big things, 1,000-meter routes in like the Canadian Rockies, in the Alps. I've never been to Patagonia. There's like a big ice line there that's waiting a second that I'd love to try. I certainly have no intention on not doing that style of climbing, of stopping that. I will go because it's so. Brilliant, I love it. Where you do loads of climbing, really physical, you push for 24 hours, and you're back in the valley. No problem at all. It gives me as much satisfaction that as doing like hard trad routes or very lowly level grade sport climbs that are at the top of my ability. But so I have no problem with that. Which in some respects are like as much climbing as you do in the Himalayas or whatever. But I'm pretty sure I'm done for the greater ranges. I'm just getting a bit too superstitious.
I have to say you seem like you mean it a lot more
than you have. Yeah. Pretty sure I'm done with that.
Yeah. We'll see, won't we?
Yeah, we'll see.
52 is the new 35.
It bloody didn't feel it. Feels pretty old, I'll tell you.
Right, we'll leave it there.
Yeah.
Thanks very much.
No worries. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. For more information, visit theadventurepodcast.co.uk, and you can find us and follow us on Instagram at The Adventure Podcast. The podcast is produced in association with Sidetrack magazine, so for an extra adventure fix, visit sidetrack.com. The podcast is produced and distributed by Pip Saunders and Alex Hall. And as always, please do head over to iTunes and leave us a review. They make a huge, huge difference.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud. Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.